Major Chadwick and Sujata Sen. From the unpublished Chadwick's Bible, Chapter 38, Initiation, Louis Buss tells the story of Dr. Suzanne Sen, popularly known as Sujata Sen, and how Major Chadwick appears to have befriended her and helped her adjust to the way of Bhagavan. In September 1940, a ship carrying troops and civilian passengers set sail from Liverpool. On board were a French woman called Jean Curtil and Monica, her half-Indian granddaughter. They had until now been living together in Brighton, where they may well have passed various members of the Chadwick family on the street, without ever realizing that they were distantly connected. Now, Jean and Monica were on their way to start a new life in India, away from the growing dangers of the war. Having survived an air raid on the eve of departure, the liner safely escaped English waters, though Monica was unable to comprehend why the captain kept zigzagging around instead of just going in a straight line. She was too young to be told that they were dodging German U-boats. Eventually, having taken the long route around the Cape of Good Hope, Jean and her granddaughter docked in Bombay. There, they were met by Suzanne Sen, who was Jean's daughter and Monica's mother. She was in a car which she had herself driven up from the south, covering a distance of some 750 miles. Even today, it would be an epic drive and one which few Western women would consider undertaking alone. But Suzanne was a remarkable person whose great qualities went far beyond her courage and spirit of adventure. She was a gifted dancer, a medical doctor, in an age when the profession was very much a male preserve. The first Theravadan Buddhist priestess in 800 years, a feminist firebrand and fierce anti-vivisectionist. In other words, like Chadwick, she was ahead of her time. Also, like him, she was a pilgrim. After a spiritual journey no less tortuous and intense than Arthur Osborne's, she too had eventually wound her way to Arunachala and the feet of Ramana Maharishi. Suzanne had naturally been apprehensive about her mother and daughter making the hazardous journey from England to India, but the Maharishi had personally assured her that they would be quite safe. Shortly afterwards, she had a dream in which she saw him sitting outside their house in Brighton with his hand raised in a gesture of protection. Now here they were, and soon three generations of the family were in the car together, bumping south towards Arunachala. The day after their arrival, young Monica stepped into the old hall to behold the man about whom she had already heard so much from her mother. At first, she writes, "I was a little afraid to come before her great master, about whom she had written so much to us. But when he looked at me, I felt wonderfully safe and happy. He seemed to be infinitely wise and yet completely innocent, like a child. I saw in him great sweetness and gentleness. At the same time, I felt his power." After a falling out with the Theosophical Society, Monica's mother first went to the ashram in December 1936, just after the visit of Perumal Swami's lawyer. We were by now so familiar with the sofa and the revolving bookcase that it is perhaps difficult to imagine what sort of impact they must have made on a newcomer. But this strange hybrid place, half meditation hall and half suburban living room, was perhaps the last thing one would expect to find in a jungle hermitage. Apart from the incense burner, which smoked before the couch, there was nothing to suggest that you were in a religious institution at all. The hall was a peculiar mixture of the public and the private, a home to which a theater had been attached, where a man who had no personal life lived out his hours in public view. There sat the sole inhabitant behind his little fence, his loincloth jarringly at odds with his suburban sitting, so that he looked like some wild man of the woods imprisoned in a Victorian drawing room. For Ramana was one of the rishis of the world, a relic from the age when giants walked the earth. He was a colossus in captivity, a caged tiger, its eyes shining like amber among the potted palms and plastic rocks. Suzanne had by this time encountered her share of spiritual figures, but now she knew she had found her master. "He is an adept of the highest order," she was to write, "a king of yogis. The splendor of his realization radiates like the sun, robed in ether. His yogic powers are unique, subtle and rare. He lifts you far above the world." Already, she dreamed that she might one day be deemed worthy of acceptance as his disciple. For, as her talk of the adepts and yogic powers perhaps suggests, Suzanne was still very much under the influence of the Theosophists, according to whom initiation by a true master was the greatest prize without which no progress could ever be made. Suzanne and Chadwick quickly became friends. Both came from Catholic backgrounds and both had undertaken a similar pilgrimage, and they must have had plenty to talk about. Yet Chadwick was the senior partner in every sense. Besides being the older of the two, he had come to Bhagawan first and established himself at the heart of the ashram in a way no other Westerner could ever repeat. For Suzanne, as for many others, he was able to act as a mediator in this strange and sometimes inimical world. He was one of the few who had a relaxed relationship with Ramana, and almost as importantly, he would be able to put in a good word with Chinnaswamy when needed. All in all, his cottage was like a foreign embassy, a little piece of Western territory right at the heart of the ashram. It must have been a comfort to Suzanne that he was so easy to make friends with and so eager to help in any way he could. Suzanne settled in Thirunamalai, where she was soon running a desperately needed medical practice in the town. She threw herself into this work with her usual energy and courage, dealing with all the horrors one might expect to come across in such a remote part of India, from the terrible effects of unchecked diseases to gruesome agricultural injuries and the results of botched medical procedures carried out by village healers. She was not just brave, but selfless too, asking for payment only from those who could afford it, with the result that she ended her long career slightly in debt. For all her remarkable qualities and for all her spiritual maturity, Suzanne still suffered the pangs of unrequited love. The more she came to recognize Ramana's uniqueness the more she longed to receive initiation from him. Just as many women cannot believe they are really loved until they are officially married, so she could not accept she was really a disciple until some formal ceremony had been performed. Failing that, she needed an explicit reassurance the initiation was not necessary after all, and that Ramana was really her guru. Given the awe in which she held him, she was hardly likely to start badgering the Maharishi on the one topic he was so famously reluctant to discuss. So she put Chadwick up to it, instead making him promise never to let on that he was asking on her behalf. So it was that in 1940, some 5 years after his arrival and long after he had given up the idea of receiving initiation himself, Chadwick mysteriously began pestering the Maharishi on that very subject. Bhagavan says that he has no disciples. The reminiscences recount that as soon as he heard this opening question, Bhagavan gave Chadwick a suspicious look. Besides realizing that another cross-examination was about to start, he may already have guessed that this line of questioning couldn't have come from Chadwick himself. Yes, but Bhagavan also says that for the majority of aspirants, a guru is necessary. Yes, this of course was just the old inconsistency that had been pointed out by Perumal Swami's lawyer a few years before. Ramana Maharishi always insisted that a guru was necessary for everyone. Of course, that didn't include him, and he could never be cornered into admitting that he was a guru himself. What then must I do? Has my sitting here all these years been just a waste of time? Must I go and look for some guru in order to receive initiation, seeing that Bhagavan says he is not a guru? Though the question might have been Susan's, the reply and its consolation applied equally to them both. What do you think brought you here, such a long distance, and made you remain so long? Why do you doubt? If there had been any need to seek a guru elsewhere, you would have gone away long ago. He went on to say that from the jnani's point of view, there could be no difference between guru and disciple. This was why he could never be brought to admit that he was a guru any more than he could be brought to sign his name on a document. Yet, from the disciple's point of view, the relationship was real. There were three ways of initiation: by touch, by look, and by silence. Ramana Maharishi's way was by silence. Then Bhagavan does have disciples. As I said, from Bhagavan's point of view, there are no disciples, but from that of the disciple, the grace of the guru is like an ocean. If he comes with a cup, he will only get a cupful. It is no use complaining of the niggardliness of the ocean. The bigger the vessel, the more he will be able to carry. It is entirely up to him. Yet, despite these tremendous and beautiful words, Chadwick went on pestering. In the end, Bhagavan humorously suggested that he should go to the ashram office and have them write him out a certificate, or even get them to put the office stamp on him. Perhaps that would satisfy him. It was about as close as Ramana Maharishi ever came to admitting that he was a guru. Arthur Osborne, who, like Suzanne, had been tormented by the desire for initiation, found the conversation so interesting that he included a full account of it in his Path of Self-Knowledge. He ends up saying that few were as persistent as Major Chadwick in the demand for an assurance, leaving us with the impression that he never realized Suzanne had been behind it all. Indeed, knowing Chadwick, he probably never let on and was happy for everyone to go on thinking he had fallen prey to a sudden doubt. His own account in the reminiscences ends with a little hint as to the truth, though it is as subtle as the hint he gives about the meditation belt. Anyhow, Bhagavan did clear the doubts of many by this conversation, in spite of which there are still some who say it was useless to go to Bhagavan because he gave no initiation and did not even recognize the relationship of master and disciple. In the original manuscript of the book, the hint is just a little more open, though it still hardly risked revealing Suzanne's secret. Of course, I had had no doubts, but I was interested to see how Bhagavan reconciled the two points of view. Yet, none of this was enough for the woman who would put him up to it. The more desperately she yearned for some sign of acceptance or love from Bhagavan, the more rocky and remote he seemed to become. Suzanne understood that, like Arunachala, he represented the ultimate absolute. Yet she needed something more human than a mountain, and some more concrete token than initiation by silence. Eventually, in 1945, after 10 years in Tiruvannamalai, she decided to leave. Her plan was to go to Swami Ramdas, another famous South Indian guru, who was himself an admirer of Ramana. Suzanne would not have been human if she had not seen this in some sense as a betrayal. The nature of her attachment to Bhagavan had always been deeply emotional. All in all, the pain of leaving Arunachala under these unhappy circumstances, after all the joy she had felt on arriving here, must have been intense. A few days before Christmas, she went to tell Bhagavan of her decision and to say goodbye. Even at this traumatic moment of parting, he did not say a single word to her. But as she watched, his appearance changed until she realized that she was now staring at Dakshinamurti, the guru of all gurus, who had taught his disciples in silence. Then, although he still didn't speak, she heard him say, "There is no separation. All gurus are one. They are the indwelling self of everyone. I shall ever remain as the jewel shining in the lotus of your heart." Suzanne was happy with Swami Ramdas. Almost as soon as she had arrived, he willingly gave her the initiation she had craved for so many years. All in all, the atmosphere was much warmer and friendlier here. After breaking herself again and again against the unfeeling rock of Arunachala, Suzanne felt she had been accepted into an extended family with Ramdas as its loving father. His spiritual children could sit and chat to him or even touch him with none of the formality and awe that surrounded the lofty, silent figure of Ramana Maharishi. Suzanne stayed for 18 blissful months as if taking a sort of spiritual rest cure. Then she returned to her rock.